Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly libertarian podcast that, unlike basically every river in Europe, has an uninterrupted flow. I did that. I am Matt Welsh, joined by, Have you seen the pictures? They're crazy. I'm Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, a spectacularly bearded Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mankiw Ward. Hi, everyone.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Howdy.
Sorry. We're going to...
You can feel this is going to be a good one. Yeah. I can feel it.
Coffee works. We're going to discuss the state of the grand old party here in a moment. But first, folks, Andrew Heaton is not just a weirdly dressed comic who once wrote a poetry book slamming the great city of Los Angeles. No, Andrew Heaton is not merely the dashing leading man in such recent TV classics as Libertarian Star Wars, Libertarian Star Trek, and Libertarian James Bond. No, Andrew Heaton, one of the nicest and wittiest Okla humans on the planet, is also the host of a podcast called The Political Orphanage, and you should go subscribe to it right the hell now. The Political Orphanage is designed for people tired of seeing the world through the lens of red versus blue, and who still maintain friendships with people they disagree with. It's chock full of interesting guests, such as Justin Amash and Andrew Yang, and you will like it. Go listen to The Political Orphanage right now. You'll be very glad you did. Okay, Catherine. After last week's various primary elections, the chess pieces are basically on the board for the 2022 midterm elections. Long projected to be a repudiation of unpopular Democratic President Joseph Robinette Biden, the putative red wave has hit a couple of snags of late. It's early yet, and Stephanie Slade isn't here to slap my wrist, but the forecasters over at 538.com currently put the odds of Democrats retaining their control of the United States Senate at 63 to 37. And if it's an odd number, that means it's even more accurate. Thanks in part to lackluster Trumpy candidates in Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Arizona. 538 still has the House flipping to GOP control by a likelihood of 78 to 22. Last week, of course, also saw the primary thumping of Wyoming Congressperson and January 6th committee star Liz Cheney, which closes the books on the 10 Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump the second time around. Four got primaried, four announced their retirement, and only two survived to make it to the general election in November. So even though Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, widely expected to make a run at the White House in 2024, is generating a lot of noise these days, a media consensus is coalescing around the idea that the GOP remains the party of Trump. Catherine, do you agree with that consensus? And what does Trump's continued potency in one of our two major political parties mean for us small L libertarians?
I will start by saying here, as I always do now, that Donald Trump's first election broke me of any desire to or confidence in my ability to predict the outcomes of elections, which is a great quality for a political journalist. So I just want to start there and say I know nothing, Jon Snow. But yeah, you know, everyone who didn't totally love Trump left the GOP. And this is not a thing that happened just in the list that you named earlier. This is a thing that has been happening since Trump arrived in the GOP. And so it is a natural conclusion that now it's Trump's party. And I don't think that means it's Trump's party forever. And I don't think that means America wants it to be Trump's party. But the fact is that jobs in politics, I think, probably kind of suck. And if you are doing them in the service of someone whose vision you don't believe in, ultimately, if the leader of your party, well, either someone whose vision you don't believe in or who doesn't believe in your vision, as is was the case with some folks who left or were kicked out of the GOP, then it's going to be an unpleasant and thankless job without the spirit of mission to animate you going forward. So, yeah. It's Trump's GOP now, and I don't think we needed this last round of annoying primaries
to tell us
that.
What does
it mean for us? Why is that? If it's Trump's GOP, then what is to be done?
It's bad news for libertarians.
It's bad for libertarians.
It's very, very bad news for libertarians because Trump's GOP does not have the streak which many other recent variants of the GOP have had, which is a libertarian leg on the stool, a libertarian, you know, invite to the party, at least some passing libertarian rhetoric. For the most part, I think the things that Trump did that were good for libertarians were the result of inattention or occasional passing convergence. I do not believe he's animated by any kind of libertarian impulses for the most part. And yeah, you know, given that libertarians have failed to get any purchase in the American left, in the Democratic Party, the Republicans that were at least friendly or sometimes part of a libertarian coalition, I think, are largely gone now. And that is bad news.
Peter, I stepped on your
beard. I just want to argue very slightly with Catherine's argument that that people who didn't love Trump left the GOP. Actually, some of them stayed in the Republican Party and just decided to put up with Trump. Mitch McConnell, for example, is well known to not be a fan of Donald Trump. And there's always these kind of reports coming out of his office, you know, these kind of thinly sourced anonymous reports, you know, about Mitch McConnell's really upset this time. But then in public, Mitch McConnell basically has chosen to play ball with a Trumpified Republican Party, because Mitch McConnell's priority, as always, is Republican vote share, is that he doesn't ever want to be apart from the Republican base, and he doesn't ever want to lose seats, and he's not willing to take any kind of stand over Trump if it would cost the party. And I also think he thinks it would probably be futile, and given the Cheney election here, he might be right. But, you know, there's like a lot of the people who are operating even in leadership positions in the Republican Party right now are not people who like Donald Trump, but they see that the Republican base likes Donald Trump. And this is an issue of, you know, of demand from the Republican voting base, that leadership does not feel they have any power to do anything about, and they don't want to lose their jobs.
Nick, you said last week on the Reason Roundtable podcast that even though you were rooting for Trump to beat Biden in November 2020, the president's conduct after the election kind of disqualified him in your eyes. So the question to you, do you think people should be single issue voters on the notion when it comes to candidates who claim that the 2020 election was stolen?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think also last week I talked about and I'll re-recommend the fantastic Robert Draper, New York Times Magazine story about the GOP in Arizona, which goes long on this very topic. And, you know, right there is somebody like Carrie Lake, who is, you know, likely to become the next governor of Arizona. She's the Republican nominee, who is insane. I think if you know, if not believing in generally understood reality is one definition of insane, she's going to score like a 4 out of 10 on that. She's also great on school choice, or at least vocally so far. You know, Doug Ducey, the outgoing governor who did not support her, is the guy who passed all the school choice legislation there. But she has pledged to back it to the hilt. That's, if I was in Arizona, that would be a tough question. Somebody who is nuts, but is very good on an issue that's really of central importance to me. I don't think, you know, and this might be, Matt, that at the individual level, you know, whether as an individual voter or when you're talking about a particular race, it's not a disqualifying thing that somebody is nuts, but they believe, you know, they'll vote to the hilt on one or two or three of your main issues. Overall, for the Republican Party, I think it's a problem. They are going to win the House. They still may win the Senate. There's a lot to see what goes on. But they may be back in power, you know, congressionally in a couple of months, even as they are going so far down the road of delusion and where all they talk about is election fraud. They're going to keep talking about it even if they win, like Donald Trump did. This is a party, and the Democratic Party has had a version of this too, where they reach a peak of power or an apogee of power just as they are at their most idiotic and insane and deranged, and then it fritters away. And that's really, in many ways, that's been the story of the 21st century, of these unstable majorities that disappear. The Republican Party, from a libertarian point of view, has less and less to any attraction whatsoever. You know, they had a rhetoric that was libertarian, and occasionally they had actions that were libertarian, but they don't have that anymore. And, you know, the not the LP members, but, you know, small L libertarians, which I think is everyone on this call or on this podcast, like we need to figure out how to affect more influence on the major parties and possibly on the LP itself.
Catherine, we've referenced Doug Ducey's pretty radical reform in Arizona, attaching something like $7,000 or even a little bit more per child who goes to K-12, and the parents can take that money and spend it however they want to on their education. It's really, it's backpack funding, as the Reason Foundation, which publishes this podcast, has been talking about for many, many years. Is there, in light of that, a kind of updated Butt Gorsuch interpretation of the modern GOP in which, sure, we're all paying attention because we're stupid and we live in New York and Washington, D.C., respectively, and we're addicted to national politics and so therefore hyper-focused on whatever the pretenders to the presidential throne might say. But is there, on a lower, closer to the ground level, some interesting and good things happening with school choice around the country, and perhaps some other issues that are not getting as much attention?
Yeah, I mean, it would be foolish of us to do the work we do if we thought that we were never making any progress on any issues of importance to us at any level of government. And it does so happen for, I think, fascinating historical reasons that the GOP is the party of school choice. And I'm delighted to see stuff like that happening, just like, of course, I have followed with great glee all of the drug legalization efforts in various states, which are usually sort of lefty, though sometimes interestingly righty. And, you know, similarly with criminal justice reform and some other policies. Yeah, on the state level, we sometimes get something we want, and it is good to pay attention to that and care about it and celebrate it when it happens. But I think the certainly the question that people are talking about in, as you say, the garbage cities we live in, is what the heck is going on with the National Republican Party? And I just really don't see, even school choice at the national level is, you know, to me, it echoes a lot of the ways that the GOP has talked about fiscal discipline in the past. They're saying the right words, but I don't see them doing the right thing. And that's for deeper structural reasons, for the most part, including that, thank God, the federal government is mostly not in charge of our K-12 education system. But, you know, I see that as mostly rhetorical. And as you say, the real change, if there is positive change, is happening at the state level.
Peter, you're from Florida. Last week, a federal judge struck down as unconstitutional Governor Ron DeSantis's Stop Woke Act, which had attempted to ban even private companies from conducting training sessions that included certain tenets that were allegedly derived from critical race theory. A defiant DeSantis said he will never surrender to woke ideology and vowed that Florida is where woke goes to die. So
given just that, like a vast majority of its residents.
Gillespie wins the podcast 15 minutes in. It's a little bit earlier than usual.
See you next week.
Peter, given that so far DeSantis is basically the only other major contender for 2024 in the Republican Party, as in this preliminary Stephanie Slade slaps my wrist date. How is DeSantisism looking to you right now?
Well, on the specific issue that you raised, the Stop Woke Act, I think it's part of a pretty clear pattern that demonstrates that Ron DeSantis does not give one whit about free speech. And I mean, yeah.
Whit?
A whit. He doesn't care at all about
He's a monster.
Actual
not even a
free
thing.
Speech. He doesn't care about constitutional freedoms, and I think that's a real problem, because DeSantis, with the Stop Woke Act and with the social media law that he passed, he put both of those laws, he signed both of those laws knowing that they were unconstitutional. It wasn't just like lefty ACLU guys saying, hey, we're going to challenge this. This was, you know, right of center constitutional experts were like, yeah, this is a stunt. This is just for, you know, sort of playing to the base, and the courts are going to put a stop to it. And Ron DeSantis was just like, I don't care. I'm going to go ahead and do this anyway, because I want the attention that is going to come from signing these laws into effect. And so there's two things that are bad about that. One is, it's bad to sign laws that are probably almost certainly unconstitutional. And the second is, I don't care for politicians who engage in that sort of stunt policy, where the policy isn't a real thing that is intended to go into effect. It is instead just designed to generate attention for the politician, designed to make people mad, designed to sort of get people talking about how Ron DeSantis is the worst or the best, or he's the only one, you know, he's the bulwark between us and the stupid woke left or whatever. That sort of look at me policymaking is corrosive and not helpful to the polity. And Ron DeSantis loves that stuff because it's what gets people talking about Ron DeSantis. It doesn't actually, in the end, do anything to advance even the goals that he wants, much less the ones that I have here. And so I think it's a real problem that the Republican Party has decided to go with either, you know, it really seems like it's either going to be Trump or DeSantis who ends up with the nomination in 24. And either one of those guys is somebody who is just a showman, who is just somebody who says, who wants attention for its own sake and because they believe that it's politically valuable and will help their political careers. Neither of them have policy agendas that they are working, you know, diligently and like in a kind of competent sort of gubernatorial governor, you know, governing sort of way to advance. And the Republican Party base, you know, I mean, I guess you can understand why they would go that route, because the Republican Party base does not itself seem to have much of a policy agenda, certainly like a national economic policy agenda that they want, that they care about. They just want their guys in office so that they can see that their guys are winning and are making fun of the bad liberals who make them feel uncomfortable.
Nick, yesterday was kind of an interesting day in the media criticism or media navel gazing industry, in that it was the last broadcast of CNN's Reliable Sources, mm-hmm. Brian Stelter, yep. That had been going on for years.
Nine years, I think.
He was, yeah, 9 years, but the show.
Okay. Under Howie Kurtz.
The Kalb brothers and Howie Kurtz.
Oh, my God, the Kalb brothers.
They're still with us, by the way, at least one of them. But also Margaret Sullivan, who used to be the reader's representative of the New York Times and a longtime columnist for the Washington Post. She wrote her final column as well. And both of those people have figured prominently in kind of the post-Trump journalism rethink. There's a quote from Margaret Sullivan's piece. Journalists certainly shouldn't shill for Trump's 2024 rivals, whoever they may be, but they have to be willing to show their readers, viewers, and listeners that electing him again would be dangerous. That's a tricky tightrope to walk, Margaret Sullivan said. Brian Stelter said in his thing, in his close, the free world needs CNN to be strong. Nick,
yeah.
Do you want to reflect a little bit about how journalism, or sort of the mainstream elite journalism, has reconsidered itself or reconfigured itself in the wake of Trump, and whether that's been a good or a bad thing?
I think the kernel of truth in the cliche ridden, self-aggrandizements that you just quoted from, is that journalists should be upfront about their bias. And it's not that they should necessarily give in to their bias, but like people should know more about that, so that nobody is mistaking anything being spoken by the voice of God that is actually, you know, spoken by somebody who's incredibly ideological and traffics almost exclusively in confirmation bias without even putting up a fight. I think what has happened in the as a result of Trump, and it's bigger than him. It started before and it will continue long after he's actually gone, is that most journalists have not gotten the message. I think that, it is one thing to kind of be upfront about what your priors are or where you're coming from, and that can actually instill trust and confidence. It make your work more persuasive, or you can kind of make a nod to that and just become more ideological without admitting it. It makes your work less interesting and less useful and less insightful. And, you know, if there's a lesson to be drawn out of all of this, it might come not from people that are still in the mainstream, but more like people like Matt Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald and whatnot, where these are people who are, you know, distinctly anti
kind of normal partisan politics, although they, you know, they pick sides and all of that. They have freed themselves to speak how they want to speak and write about what they want to write with passion and with, you know, kind of something approaching epistemological disclosure. And their work is much more interesting and I think gives more insight than the kind of burnt out husks. There's a version of this, you know, that Sean Hannity is doing, and there's a version of this that most of the people at MSNBC or CNN are doing. And there's a reason why cable news is no longer where people go to get news. Or, you know, they don't care about it in the same way. And it's also why the New York Times had to be turned into the world's largest, you know, subscriber newsletter. Because it, you know, you may do well in this. Most of the time you won't, but you are going to be speaking to the converted. And that's, you know, that's that. So I the short answer is, I think journalists have drawn almost exclusively the wrong message from, you know, being faced with the idea that Trump is not merely a bad opponent, but he is an existential threat to the world that I love. And so I'm going to try to, sledgehammer people into believing that, even if I give up trying to convince them of that. Instead, I'll just lecture them.
Catherine, last word on this, in this segment of the podcast. Liz Cheney, in her speech, did a lot of, you know, we're just getting started. And there's been some excitement from the Never Trump media opolis, basically the bulwark and your ex-colleagues at the Weekly Standard, about a possible Liz Cheney run to fight Donald Trump. I know you're not supposed to be laying odds on this. What do you think about the perennial Never Trump excitement for people to be the moths on the windshield of the Republican Party?
It's probably not going to work out, just like all the other ones didn't work out. I don't know. I mean, you know, we, of course, as watchers of the Libertarian Party, if not members, know the challenges that a non-major party candidate faces in the electoral arena. And it's hard for me to imagine a Liz Cheney run making a dent in anything substantial about politics. But I am sympathetic to the hope that springs eternal in the hearts of the bulwarkers, because the options look terrible, really terrible for the next election, even more terrible than usual. And I say that as someone who didn't think the bar could get lower. So sure, try your Liz Cheney, but it's not going to work.
I also think that a Liz Cheney run, even if you completely agree with her about Trump, has a real problem, which is that it's inevitably only going to be about Donald Trump. And you can't win a presidential election on a "that guy is really bad" platform.
She's going to do a Bill Weld, right? Like, even if she did make a titchy bit of headway in the end, she's going to be like, just vote for Biden.
All right, we're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp.com. What are you doing right now to work on the most important organ in your body, your brain? Some people will literally exercise 7 days a week or experiment with insanely complicated diets or watch the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe in chronological order rather than devoting some real time to working on that fateful lump between their ears. BetterHelp Online Therapy is here to say, let's take care of that brain. BetterHelp is customized online therapy delivered via video, phone, live chat, or any technological method you prefer. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy. You can be matched with a professional in under 48 hours. And you can keep trying out new therapists until you find someone that really clicks. Roundtable listeners get 10% off their first month. Just go to betterhelp.com/roundtable. That's better, HELP.com/roundtable, and get started today. Go ahead. Go there. Your brain will be glad you did. All right. Reminder, email us your succinct queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from the delightfully, if perhaps fictitiously named, Swift Griggs. What kind of boys' novel name is that? This is the Swift Griggs series. All right. Sorry. Dear Reason crew, what is the smallest size in which a free market can work. Is three people enough, or do you need country-sized populations to reap the benefits? We love free trade, but what about when we trade with slavers and criminal regimes? Why would it not be better to close trade to them and just keep most of our trade internal or with our free-ish pals? Is America's market not big enough to reap the benefits of free trade internally? Even if nobody would send us imports, would we not just creatively find replacements for all the products that we used to import? Catherine, we're big country. Why not?
So free trade does work between three people. It does work internal to a nation. It works better the bigger the pool is. And so I think that the question that this question raises is who is we in the question, you know, can't we just work internally? Can't we just creatively find replacements? The problem with a scenario in which we say these people are worthy of trading with, or this nation is worthy of trading with, and this one is not, is that we're going to disagree about those lines. And if we use the mechanism of state power to make those choices, A, it's the state, so they're going to get it wrong, spectacularly wrong, stupidly wrong in a thousand different ways. And B, it will, you know, it will not conform to lots of people who are trapped within those trade barriers preferences. So my view is like, yes, I personally, Catherine Mengu Ward, maybe should try to not trade with regimes or countries or companies that I don't approve of their business practices. You, Swift Griggs, an incredibly named person, should perhaps tailor your choices in who you do business with according to your values. I think that's reasonable. And that's one reason that I actually prefer, you know, I try to have reason not scream too loud about how like this boycott is dumb, whatever boycott it is, because sometimes boycotts, even boycotts of one person, can make sense. But I don't think that the way forward is to say, oh, we got the good guys and the bad guys, and we're going to trade with the good guys only because trade is still good enough with the good guys. Trade is still good with just the good guys, but it, in my view, is better the more people are involved in the system.
Nick, what say you to Swift Griggs?
You know, the first thing I did was look up what's the percentage of imports, or what, you know, how much are imports of the U.S. economy, and it's about 13%. Exports are about 10%. So, and this is worth remembering for many developed countries, and certainly the United States, the vast majority of our economic activity is within and among people in the United States. To begin with. So in a lot of ways, the idea that, you know, and people say this all the time, like we've got to stop imports because they're screwing over local businesses and stuff. It's much less important in that sense than you think. But it's also good. It's a moral good and it's an economic good. I think of when people start to say, oh, well, let's not trade with bad countries. I think of North Korea. Are people in North Korea better off or worse off because they're effectively cut out of the global economy? Is the regime in North Korea or in Cuba, the U.S. boycott or embargo of Cuban goods, did that work to change the internal politics? No, but it definitely has helped to reduce the standard of living in places like North Korea. So I take seriously the idea, and we often fail at this, but when you trade with a country, you're not merely trading goods and services. You also have an opportunity to trade values and to bring people into your standard of living, but also into your country. So I am, let it rip all the time, everywhere.
I mean, this question is actually about China, right? And that's fair. That, you know, our theory, our sort of Tom Friedman, but not stupid theory of trading with China was maybe that we would just turn them into, America with like better noodles or something, and that didn't happen. And so that
didn't
is like
happen
fully,
yet. I mean,
it's a fully legit question to ask. And of course, doubly so. Did China, in the process of trading with them, turn us a little bit communist or a little bit authoritarian or censorious? Again, fair questions, but I think that in that conversation, people often lose sight of the, you know, undeniable, incredible gains to well-being of a billion people in China. And that's always worth considering too. Like when we say, well, Am I morally pure if I traded with China? Maybe a little less so, but it depends on how you account morality. And if you say something that's incumbent on me morally is to improve the lives of as many people as possible in this messed up world, then maybe it comes out in the wash.
The United Nations Millennium Project, I think it was called, was a goal, I think, set around in 1990-ish, maybe a little bit later. It's not important, but it was basically to reduce global extreme poverty. And it went so much faster than projected. And the United Nations said when discussing it and continuing to measure this that, you know what, when we first set this out, we thought that global aid would be the thing to turn the tide. And in fact, that hasn't been it. It's been trade. Trade has lifted, has been the most responsible factor in lifting 1 billion people out of extreme poverty, which is a rate never before seen ever. We were talking 50 years ago about mass starvation events all over Asia. And now we no longer talk about that. And that's a good thing.
So trade works very well at large scale and at small scale. The best demonstration of small scale gains from trade I have ever seen came in a little classroom with, I don't know, maybe 50 people. I was in my 20s. Most of the people there were in their 20s. And the speaker handed out little candies, and I think in some cases, like little tiny plastic toys to everyone. And each person started with one. And then this, and you just got randomly assigned whatever you were given, right? And so, and then the speaker says, so how many people like what you have right now? And maybe 25, 30% of the class raises their hand. And the speaker says, okay, now you have 15 minutes, trade, do whatever you want with these things. And then we're going to check back in, right? Like you have to see if you can get yourself into a better position. And so people engage in all sorts of kind of complicated trading mechanisms after this. Some people actually whip out their wallets and, like, you know, buy candy off of each other. Some people end up with like three pieces of candy. Some people end up with none, but they're still happier because like what they wanted was to not have a little dinosaur or a little, you know, box of candy that they didn't like. And at the end, the speaker comes back in and of course says, now raise your hand if you are happier with the thing you have now than you were 15 minutes ago. And like three quarters of the class raises their hand, right? It didn't, you know, affect every single person, but it really, like, it, those in that 15 minutes, people gained a very small amount of wealth because they suddenly had something that was more to their preferences. So free trade can work in very, very, very small systems. But obviously it works better when it's at large scale. So I would actually just, I would reverse the question in some ways. And I would say that the thing you, like, if you are going to target some group for exclusion from trade, you should make that targeting as narrow and specific as possible. Right. And so, like, it is one thing to, like, I think it's a bad idea to just say we're not going to trade with China or we're going to limit trade with China. It's a huge country that's not all communists. That, like, yes, the country, like, commits, the government there commits terrible human rights abuses, is, you know, authoritarian, surveillance oriented, just does all sorts of stuff that is anti-libertarian and anti-American and kind of awful. And yet not everyone is involved in all of that. So if you're if you're going to have some sort of trade limitation, don't target governments that, you know, sort of oversee people who may or may not be involved in the government's projects. Like, it might be okay, I think, to say, hey, this murder boat full of like 50 guys who just go around murdering and stealing, we're not going to allow them at our ports and their stuff. Like, we're not going to do that.
Why you got to do pirates dirty like that,
yeah.
Suderman?
Sorry, the murder boat, the one specific murder boat full of people.
Really one of the biggest problems in international trade right now.
And so that sort of thing is much more legitimate to me than like, oh, this nation has bad policies or is bad to its citizens or, you know, is bad for the world. And because, like, you know, I mean, Catherine's point, you know, Matt's point about the ways, it's not just that it has raised the standards of living of people in China, it's also raised the standards of living of people in the United States. We have access to large amounts of inexpensive goods. We have material abundance that we would not have. And that helps people here as well as in China. And that's true all over the world. And so there's, you know, or spillover effects from this sort of thing. And so in general, I am in the camp that everybody else is in here, which is to say that we should, it's obviously not overlook human rights abuses by authoritarian governments, especially when they are committed at the scale that China commits them. At the same time, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't engage in commerce with the country or that we should heavily restrict it, because I it's hard for me to imagine that it, if that the alternative is like that, the alternative world is one in which China is still authoritarian, but everyone is less well off.
I also love that Nick is casually joking like, lol, what if we made our trade policy around concerns about piracy? And it's like, we definitely did. Like a lot of the ways that we have like international law structured at this time in the year of our Lord 2022 is like, okay, we're going to need to figure out what to do about like the Barbary pirates. And, you know, and it shows.
Murder boats are still bad.
Murder boats have never been good, but I am happy to announce they're at probably a historic low.
I think that's probably true. Wait till we get
probably fortune. Because free trade makes pirating not a very successful strategy.
Okay, but hear me out. Space murder boats.
I will add to this fascinating conversation
just about that murder boats.
The last two administrations, including this current one, have engaged in more tariffing than we've seen basically since World War II. At least the trajectory of tariffs on the planet has stopped its previously relentless march downward and has started to poke upwards, and it's made stuff more expensive here. And contributed to inflation, contributed to lots of things that we don't like. And that's not surprising. That's widely predicted. And so that has to enter into anybody's calculation of, do we gain something from things being more expensive? And do we also note that the application of these tariffs, to Peter's point, are not surgical? It's like, oh, we can use this national security tariff against China? Cool, because we're totally going to do it with Canada about wood. And that's just stupid and bad. And that's how it works in the world. So it makes things more expensive. Another point, and is always to bring up Ceausescu whenever possible. I'm just doing that for Catherine. And just the libertarian ladies of Romania, is that Nicolae Ceausescu, the dictator of Romania, who was in the good graces of Richard Nixon and Queen Elizabeth, let us not forget, in the 1970s, because he was anti-Soviet Union. But in the 1980s, he decided that we're going to do it all ourselves. Enough of this trade, enough of this, you know, foreign currency coming in. We are going to take care of it all within the borders of this pretty big country. And it was one of the single most disastrous public policies enacted anywhere in the world in the 1980s. Granted, we're not Romania yet, but but it's just generally, you know, there are gains from specialization that we all gain from. All right, moving on. Last week, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which we for some reason called the CDC instead of the CDC&P.
I think you answered your own question.
Thank you,
there.
Matt. You must have been working on that all weekend.
No, it just like came to me. Like, it's just like it's inspiration. Anyways, announced a major reorganization, or announced that the reorganization that it was doing was major in light of the agency's COVID performance. Director Rochelle Walensky said, quote, "To be frank, we are responsible for some pretty dramatic, pretty public mistakes, from testing to data to comms." I hate the use of the word comms like that. Just want to say
she's talking about communications or communists.
I believe so. Or like walkie-talkies. Okay. But, you know, same.
I think people use that word because they think it's impactful.
You are going to die on a murder boat. Peter, what do we make of these changes? What do we make of this admission? And what are the chances going forward that the CDC won't screw the pooch when it comes to the new plague?
Well, I think the CDC has some sense that they may have a problem. Like, there's a little bit of self-awareness creeping in, or maybe being forced in via injection. And to me, this looks like the CDC has become aware, not really that they have like a problem as a health bureaucracy, but this looks like an admission that they understand that they have a political problem, which is that the political apparatus now understand, right, is now aware that the public health bureaucracies don't work, especially in the emergencies for which they are most needed or most intended to be effective anyway. And I don't have a whole lot of hope that this sort of that this reform program will produce positive results here, because fundamentally the CDC has just has departed from its core mission here. And there's a great Ron Bailey piece that we have on Reason.com that just says, look, you can try and communicate better and more clearly. You can try and process information a little bit more more swiftly, you know, and in some, maybe you will make some improvements around the edges. But what the CDC needs to do is go back to being an agency that just fights infectious disease. Because the CDC has just gotten so far away from doing that, that when an actual deadly infectious disease that has killed at this point now a million Americans, COVID-19 has been, you know, officially credited with killing more than a million people in the United States. And the CDC isn't prepared. The CDC wasn't prepared. The CDC just botched it at every stage of like the test kit rollout, the communications about masks and closures and like 3 feet in schools and 6 feet distance, you know, standing 6 feet apart, and whether or not, you know, COVID was airborne. They were so slow. They were so far behind the curve. It was actually, if you were trying to stay up on the best sort of the best science about COVID-19 as it was developing, you were much better off reading interested generalists, you know, in the New York Times and on Substack and in the Atlantic and at Reason and other places. The experts themselves were not really very reliable guides to what we know today and what we know this week. And that's a big problem when the CDC exists and has a huge budget and is supposed to be the guide to for both the public and for policymakers. But the other thing here is, I started by talking about this as a political problem. The weird thing to me is that the CDC is doing this on its own, right? This came from in the House. They were like, okay, we're going to start a reform program here. And that comes after several years of Republican criticism of the public health bureaucracy. You know, I mean, Ron DeSantis just absolutely goes after Fauci for his role and, you know, telling people to wear masks and closing schools and, you know, all that stuff. And in some ways, some of that is deserved. I don't know if folks here saw when Robbie Suave interviewed Fauci recently and about what he would have done differently. And his answer was, Fauci's answer was, you know what? What we should have done is locked down a lot harder and had a lot more stringent controls in place during COVID. The real problem was that we weren't strict enough. Just awful, awful stuff. Republicans are right to criticize that stuff, but what they haven't done is offer any programmatic reform plan for the public health bureaucracy. There's not even like a white paper floating around right now. There's no legislation in place. And it's just amazing that Republicans have spent how many years now saying this stuff is bad, and they haven't put forth any plan at all to fix it. All they want to do, and this goes back to the kind of DeSantis style of only wanting to run on things to get attention rather than wanting to run on things that might actually improve, you know, policymaking, is that DeSantis in particular has just been and like I said, often correctly critical of Fauci and of the public health apparatus, but has not himself offered, as far as I know, any meaningful plan to reform the federal public health bureaucracy. And that's a real failing for the party that is supposed to be there trying to fix this stuff.
Nick, you're our captain of low trust ramifications.
Thank you, Matt. I've been inspiring low trust and confidence for 59 years now.
Can you speculate darkly what how the just not even erosion, but explosion of trust, destruction of trust that has the public health apparatus has engaged in over the last couple of years. What that is lead to, just in terms of people's own personal beliefs. Are we going to get to the point, and are we getting to the point where people are like, you know what? I'm not sure that the polio vaccine is a good idea after all.
Well, you know, I mean, it's starting with the idea that, you know, we were supposed to wash our hands while singing Happy Birthday, but actually to kill the germs, it's got to be the album version of American Pie. I don't think people are going to do that, Matt. Call me crazy, but yeah, you know, there are two broad outcomes of this, right? One is that everybody just becomes darker and darker and more kind of nihilistic. And I think that's the America, that's the timeline we're on, where every election, and you see this in a lot of discussions about politics now, you know, whether or not Trump, the raid on Mar-a-Lago is justified or not, Trump haters will be like, well, he deserves it anyway. And then, you know, on the other side, people will be like, you know, even if it's not true that Trump lost the election, we should talk about that because it will get us to where we want to be. I mean, there's a kind of epistemological, political, cultural nihilism that is really growing and taking root, where the specifics of any charge doesn't matter as long as it gets you to where you think you should be because your side deserves to be in power. That's the timeline we're on. The one that, you know, that we can flip towards, or you know, again, the broad, you know, opposite of that is where people actually reject the, you know, the idea of being governed by elites. And that doesn't mean there is no governance, but it means that we demand actual kind of transparency, honesty, and competency among the people who govern us, while also restricting the amount of power and control they have over our everyday lives. And that, to me, that is the libertarian mission. That is the thing that we've been outlining in various ways, you know, both implicitly and explicitly, a reason for 50 years. That is the only way forward, because the dispersion and decentralization of knowledge and the breakdown of gatekeeper institutions that is part and parcel of a modern economy, particularly, you know, one that is empowered by the internet and by all sorts of ways to work around, you know, power nodes in any kind of network. The future is not where there are going to be, you know, fewer sources of authority that need to be trusted by everybody and govern everything. We're going to be picking and choosing among smaller and smaller governance options. And that means the ones that are mandatory or that are hardest to get around, like governments, need to be reduced the most, and they need to be held to the absolute highest standards. That's the response that we need to be kind of emboldening in people. And you do that by pointing out the failures of overreach and the failures of the status quo and showing alternative methods of policy and of self-governance that work.
Catherine, to close us out of this segment once more, you are inside the Beltway. You're a parent. Can you give us an anecdotal update of what the straggly last restrictions there might be that you're aware of on kids now that the CDC has basically walked back all of its previous pretty heavy-handed recommendations about restrictions in schools?
Yeah, I mean, what I'm seeing is this kind of, it's actually quite similar to the way that the Title IX stuff went down at the university level, where there was this terrible official federal guidance about how to, in the case of Title IX, handle complaints about sexual misconduct or discrimination. And the schools built all this infrastructure and made all these new rules. And then when those official federal guidelines were changed or rolled back, they were like, well, we still have all this infrastructure. Let's just keep being kind of meddling douchebags. And so I'm seeing that in DC schools. There's still just this like lingering, you know, inertia is with the maskers, inertia is with the precautionary closers. And so even as the guidance changes, there's just lagging behaviors, which is frustrating for people who previously were very follow the science and follow the guidance types. Last week's kerfuffle over how many new IRS employees were going to be hired just inspired me to look up how many people work at the CDC. And it's actually surprisingly difficult to find a current number while Googling mid-podcast. But what I found is 10,000 employees in 2015 with an average pay of $108,000 a year. That is so many people. So many people. And if we are doing a big reorg and rethink on this institution, may I suggest maybe like 1/10 of that number, just as a starting round of cuts? Because I would hope, and I will say I have seen absolutely nowhere in the coverage of this reorg and of Walensky's kind of squishy mea culpa, I've seen absolutely nowhere in there any mention of, hey, you know, one thing we're definitely going to do is pull back from like obesity and gun violence and vaping and whatever else.
ATMs and drive-throughs were a big problem.
We're not gonna run the nation's rental market anymore. Like, I just, like, none of that is being talked about. And it seems to me that if we are doing reforms, that is a very obvious place to start. As Ron Bailey said, it might be cool to have an agency, like just like a small group of people that helped disseminate information about contagious epidemics. Like, that seems like, okay, I don't like any of it, but if we're 10,000 people earning $108,000 a year on average, that is not a good idea. And we could be doing clearly better with many, many fewer people.
So they should hire some more impactful comms people.
They're going to hire impactful comms. That's the thing. That's what that, like, not even reading between the lines, like, it's right there in the lines. Like, what they're saying is, you rubes didn't understand us properly. We're going to hire impactful comms people. That is absolutely what this, like, audit and, you know, rejiggering is going to end up
with. I think they need a cartoon mascot with a lot of attitude.
Hello, fellow kids.
Oh,
I'm Cedric,
the Philadelphia
the CDC.
Philly of, of infectious
Cedric.
Diseases.
Wait, you mean like,
I don't know.
Cedric is like good. Joe Camel?
Like
Joe Camel is underemployed. You could probably pick him up. You could probably pay him in camel bucks.
Oh my God. What if the CDC acquired the rights to Joe Camel?
Yeah.
I'm now in favor of government. Sorry.
Yeah. He could be like the Whitaker Chambers of public health.
Did Nick microdose everybody except me on this podcast this morning?
Why? What's your problem?
Exactly.
What about you and your kids and the schools in New York City, Matt? The biggest and most consequential school district in all of Christendom.
Shrinking massively by the day. I don't know. I have one kid in private school. They're chill. And I don't even know where my teenager is going to school in 3 weeks. So ask me in a while. Let's get to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming in the cultural sphere and why it must at this late date have something to do with dragons. Dragons?
Yeah.
We dragons. Talking about dragons? Peter, why don't you go first?
So I watched.
I'm going to go outside for take a walk around the block, Matt. I'll see you in 15, 20 minutes.
You know what? I would respect that. It's fine.
I watched House of the Dragon, the Game of Thrones prequel on HBO. And I mostly enjoyed it. I don't think it was great, but it was pretty good. Very solid, you know? At the same time, a show like this has a challenge in that it is, you know, designed to scratch a lot of the same itches as the original show, right? Like, it's designed to do sort of the same thing again, but different. And that HBO actually shot another pilot for a different spinoff starring Naomi Watts and didn't produce a series based on it at all. They just canceled it and you'll never see that pilot because they felt like the Naomi Watts pilot wasn't enough like the original Game of Thrones. And so my worry here is that House of the Dragon is just going to sort of end up being a kind of pretty good imitator echo that is designed to remind you of how much you liked the original show, hopefully without reminding you of how much you hated the final season. At the same time, you know, the source material is, I am told, I haven't actually read it myself, but our in-house experts say that it the source material has some interesting twists and turns. The production is lavish. you know, it's enjoyable to watch. But this isn't something like Better Call Saul that took the material from, you know, from Breaking Bad and turned it into what I think is actually an even better show than the original. This looks to me like a show that is probably going to end up being at least a little bit timid because it doesn't want to depart too much from the formula that worked and from some of the stuff that people, you know, from this sort of like, oh, remember how much you loved Game of Thrones, right? From the nostalgic appeal of the show that ended 3 years ago, which we now have nostalgia for.
Catherine, did you watch some Dragons too?
I sure did. I'm just going to join Peter Suderman in his watch you consuming and say, I also watched the show. Here are my quick takes. They will be quick. One, I enjoyed the All Cops Are Bastards subplot that we had in the first episode, just like a bunch of cracking heads in ways that it's going to have ramifications down the line. Two, just the costume design situation. Absolutely incredible. I know that this is like a dude heavy podcast audience, but I got to tell you, like, just the embroidery situation alone, wild. Seriously, I found myself like, you know, wondering about like, is this like more of like a early Renaissance style? What are we looking at? Because it's, of course,
I really appreciate how like your voice turns into nearly like a growl when you say that. You're like, the embroidery situation alone. It's fierce, Catherine.
What I do want to say is that I have looked at a Targaryen family tree. And so, shut up, Matt. Shut up. And so, I know too much already. I don't want to spoil anything, but if you want to enjoy this show in real time, don't look at a Targaryen family tree, I guess, is my advice for our viewers and listeners. And Matt, you are out here being like, ooh, dragons, blah, blah, blah. What are you going to do next week when Lord of the Rings series drops? Suddenly you're not too good for dragons, huh?
The same thing I do every week, which is drink myself to sleep and cry. And maybe watch some Angels baseball on my laptop.
That's implied in the drinking yourself to sleep and crying, Matt.
It sure is. No, thanks for reminding me, actually, that that's happening. I'll see how long it takes until they get to the plaintive hobbit flute, and then I will throw a file cabinet through
what
my television.
What did plaintive flutes do to you? You hate them in Lord of the Rings. You hate them in Harry Potter. Why are you a hater?
Because it's a terrible sound. It's like someone is taking a bobby pin and jamming it through my ear hole. It's
first
no
all,
good.
Sexist. Wow.
There's a plaintive flute in Death of a Salesman, too, Matt.
Again?
You're clear of that.
What have I been doing here?
No.
Huh? Painting the walls? Gillespie, you're back from your walk. What have you
So I watched the new HBO show House of Dragons.
You
and
son of a biscuit.
And Gucci. It's a fashion show with Lady Gaga.
The
pretty
embroidery
good.
In that
it's
was
pretty
good,
too. The Italian-Americans are great in House of Dragons and Gucci. I read a book about not our fattest president, but quite possibly our finest, or one of them. It is a biography of Grover Cleveland, Buffalo's own, a man of iron, the turbulent life and improbable presidency of Grover Cleveland. It's by Troy Senek, who is perhaps best known as he's one of the people behind Kite and Key Media that put out very good explainer videos on a wide variety of topics, including things like nuclear energy and, politics and et cetera. They're really good kind of market libertarian friendly videos that call to mind a lot of Vox explainers and things like that. But Man of Iron, which is ironically titled since Grover Cleveland is like a big fat load, is a great book. It's a really good readable history of late 19th century, early 20th century political America. And Cleveland, a lot of people, you know, kind of know this, but Cleveland was a Democrat, but he
contravened a lot of the Democratic Party's policies at the time and the Republicans at the same time. And he emerges not as a libertarian president, you know, in any full form, but a libertarian-ish president. He was good on financial, like on fiscal and monetary policy for the most part. He was anti-imperialism. He was good on limited government. He was a true classical liberal, and in many ways, you know, I guess you can throw in McKinley, but McKinley was kind of a mercantilist as well, or an empire builder. But Cleveland is kind of like the last gasp of a classical liberal mentality, really, when it was a dominant strain in American life. His career is bizarre and improbable, as the subtitle puts it, because he's the only president who won two discontinuous terms in office. It's a fantastic book, and it's really... it's a great book for the current moment, because Cleveland shouldn't have been president, and his politics did not fit neatly into an era that is very similar to ours in terms of polarization and in terms of enmity and a lack of any kind of consensus of what national policy should be like. So, and beyond that, it's extremely readable and, you know, in depth. And yet concise and readable at the same time. Troy Senek's A Man of Iron, The Turbulent Life and Improbable Presidency of Grover Cleveland.
So as teased last week, I watched two feature-length documentaries, classic documentaries, with my seven-year-old daughter, both Academy Award winning. And they were as follows, widely viewed March of the Penguins and Apollo 11, the 2019 thing. And it was interesting for me, at least, to note that winning in a rout among both viewers was Apollo 11. Like, you watch those back to back on consecutive nights, and it's like, yeah, enough with the Morgan Freeman. Let's go to, like, no narrator, except for a little bit of spliced in audio from Walter Cronkite or whoever else. But it's mostly just you can sit back and enjoy the incredible 70mm footage that they found for this thing. I still can't believe they really found it after all those years, but somehow they did.
You mean they staged it? That's what I mean, just come out and say it, man.
Just like the moon landing.
I would like to see that film again in some kind of crazy movie theater IMAX situation. It must be just incredible to see those images rather than on the home screen TV.
What is so encouraging, Matt, of a big government project that ultimately yields nothing of significance for the human race?
It's really great to look at. That's what it is. And to see the kind of cocky astronaut chatter in the face of some crazy stuff. I mean, Michael Collins flying around the dark side of the moon, kind of hoping that the other two guys come back. It would be nerve wracking under a lot of circumstances. Just really thrilling to watch and beautiful. And as much of anything else, it's really great to see shots of the crowds watching on the beach and what clothes they're wearing and what station wagons they were driving and what the kids were doing. Johnny Carson sneaking through the audience and things. It's just really it's interesting to watch those two back to back, because you see kind of what happens with the heavy-handed editing and versus light-handed editing, or maybe you're getting the wool pulled over your eyes with the ostensibly light-handed editing of the Apollo 11, when in fact they had to stitch together things. It's just really both fascinating, but Apollo 11 it was, as advertised, just a jaw-dropper. And certainly impressed my 7-year-old much more than the, you know, beautiful love story and spurned dying mother or mother of a dying child.
Hey, no spoilers for House of the Dragon.
That's true. All right. That's all the spoilers we have.
House of the Penguin.
For House of the Penguin. So thank you for listening. Listen every week, every Monday, to the Reason Roundtable. Listen to all of our podcasts, including the Reason Rundown with Peter Sudeman and the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, and also the Soho Forum. Check out all that stuff at reason.com/podcasts. If you like what we do as an organization, please consider donating money to us so that we do more of it. reason.com/donate. That's it. Thank you. See you next week.